thanks everyone for coming. Today's talk is by Maria Rodriguez. Just a few words about her background. She did her undergrad in Argentina, her PhD in Barcelona, and then two postdocs, one in Max Planck, and now currently in Harvard. And she's going to be talking about force-free from a very different point of view.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back here at Perimeter. I visited for summer school when I was a graduate student almost 10 years ago, and the institute looked very different. And thank you, Luis, for having me here. So I will be talking today about some force-free electrodynamics. And in particular, I'm not going to just be talking about electrodynamics. I'm going to be talking about black holes. And so I'm going to be interested for some very particular reason of on the extremal care black holes. And I will be more precise about this. So this is a work I did in collaboration with Andy Strominger back at Harvard and Alex Lubseska, one of his great students. And so, okay, let me just tell you a little bit of more motivation on this topic. So there are some extravagant energy signals in the sky. And actually, to be more precise, is that the sky contains a variety of objects. In particular, we know that there are pulsars and quasars out there. And they produce these extravagant energetic beams. They are the highest or the largest energies in the universe. And these are collimated jets that are coming out as electromagnetic radiation. So I mentioned two things. I mentioned pulsars on one side. Pulsars, this is not an artistic, you know, representation, which usually many people like. This is actually one of the X-ray observations, the image of that, of a beam or two jets actually coming out from a rotational neutron star. So we have these pulsars on one side, and I will be focusing. Of course, I'm not going to be talking really on the astrophysics side because I'm in the theory department, but my motivation is try to describe these quasars. And quasars are also some very big jets that are coming from what we think is a supermassive black hole that is very active in the center. And so as you see here, this is also a picture which actually is just an X-ray representation of the data of in red and green and blue of the different energies of these X-rays. So we have these extravagant signals out there. So how do we think actually that these are generated? And so many of these powerful jets, in particular quasars, are generated by a giant rotating black hole surrounded by what we call a magnetosphere, with a plasma that takes a plasma at the galaxy's center. So we need both things. We need a black hole and this magnetosphere on top of that to get the jets. So, and then what is the understanding of the physics involved in this process? So there's something called the energy extraction from these black holes, and it's widely believed to be described by the highly nonlinear equations that I will show you that are these force-free electrodynamic equations. So the models, in principle, that would theoretically describe these quasars could be reduced to finding solutions to these force-free equations. So what are the force-free equations? Well, we have Maxwell's equations. This is something we all know, and we are going to use that. We have a field strength, and then on the right-hand side, a current. And so these are the inhomogeneous Maxwell's equations. And we can define a stress tensor for the electromagnetic part, which is just simply this expression over here. Then, in general, the stress tensor is not conserved when we have a current, right? So we have something here on the right-hand side of the equation. And that term over there is usually the relativistic form of the Lorentz force, okay? So keep in mind that, in principle, if we have a current in gravity, we would have some force And this is where then the name will come up for the force story in the force free equations. So, but the full stress tensor to describe these objects out there has actually two terms. There's part of the stress tensor that will be represented by the electromagnetic part, and then a bit that has to be related to the matter content in the equations. And in general, this stress tensor is actually conserved. What we believe, and this is what, well, in astrophysics, everyone believes that a good model or a good approximation to this processes is to use the force-free electrodynamics, in which the stress tensor is basically dominated by the electromagnetic bit and not matter. And so, because in this context, if we use this approximation, the stress tensor would be conserved. Actually, the electromagnetic stress tensor is conserved, and hence, on the right-hand side of the equation that we have in the previous slide, that should vanish. And this is the condition or the equation, the extra equation that we are going to solve for the force-free force-free models. So, in the study of systems obeying this special condition, the current can be defined not as a variable, but just defined by the Maxwell's equations. So, in some sense, you would take a gauge field and find, you know, what the current is, and then try to see whether you can get that condition of the field strength contracted with the current to be zero. So a complete set, actually, of equations of motion of the for the electromagnetic sector can be obtained by appending to the Maxwell's equations this equation over here. And for just the sake of simplicity on how to show you that the solutions that I will describe are actually solutions of these equations, I will more conveniently write them in forms. So basically, for people that are not even, you know, very used to forms, it's just a rewriting of the equations. So this equation over here, J wedge star of S, F is the force-free equation, and the other two is just Maxwell's equations. So in this, F, the field strength, is basically dA, where A is the gauge field. The star represents the Hodge dual. This is what we call the wedge product, and we have D dagger, which is the adjoint exterior derivative. So those are the equations that we are going to be using. So the theoretical setup is basically this, and it is actually widely believed that the black holes in the sky are actually supported with these magnetospheres composed of this electromagnetic plasma governed by these equations. And therefore, these equations are not just a mathematical, you know, interesting set of equations, but also from the physics. So let me give you a very brief, and I don't, you know, I'm going to just cite some of the references. So these equations were first, you know, looked at in the 70s. And there's one solution that Michael found where he was setting up the problem as having a Schwarzschild black hole and setting up a gauge field and seeing whether all these equations can be satisfied. And he found a very simple solution in which he could actually describe some electromagnetic field in this background of the Schwarzschild black hole. And then the following papers are by Blandford and other people. And so there's one model that we think that actually is going to be the model that describes these quasars is what Blandford and Nyack found in 77. And so what they showed is that if you have a black hole without any rotation, you cannot extract energy from it, even if you use, you know, a gauge field, if you have a gauge field there. But if the black hole is rotating, there's an ergo region. And there, if you have a field, the field will be dragged very close to the horizon. And therefore, the field lines will, you know, get entangled. And in this way, maybe these jets are produced and we can extract energy from the black hole. That's basically the idea. But because they couldn't find them analytically, what they did is they started with, you know, Michael's solution and just made some perturbations to slowly rotating. So in the parameter A for the rotation of the Kerr black hole, some perturbative solutions. And there actually, you know, it's a very valid paper, and it has been corroborated, it has been contrasted in many times in what we know as the magnetohydrodynamic simulations that have been, you know, employed now years and years in different places of the world. So there's the numerical part that actually is also contrasting the model. So there are two bits of the message. So one is that we don't know a full analytical solution to these equations. And you could say, okay, who cares? We can do numerics. But there's a catch, which is mainly that when you go to the numerics, the equations that you have to solve break down when you're very close to the extreme value of the black hole's angular momentum. And indeed, we know that there are supermassive black holes which are active and have these jets that are almost at those ranges that we cannot perform any numerical simulations. So one valid question is, can we do better? Can we actually try to solve these equations analytically and get some results from them for the extremal case? So a separate question is related to how much of, you know, yes?
What sources are you thinking of where you know that spins are seen by and they currently have jets?
You
just said that we know there are very high spinning
black holes. Not the jets, the black hole spin is very, it's almost extremal. So extremal is, so I will show you the equations of what we think is, you know, the metric that represents every black hole in the universe, and there's a constraint. And
No, I understand. So what observation were you thinking of? Are you thinking of the X-ray binary limits? Or are you thinking of...
Well, there are these solutions, there are these observations from sinus X1, which are basically 0.98% of the maximum value of the angular momentum for, you know, a given mass that the black hole has. So those, for example, and this is an active galactic, you know, nuclei.
Okay. So you think of X-ray binary limits, continuum.
Well, there's also evidence for black holes and black nuclei. Maybe not quite as tight, but...
There's a handful, but these are all very different states that I think we're thinking about here. Like these tend to be thin disks, and unlikely than launch jets. But it certainly does bring the truth that they're rapidly spinning black holes. It certainly is true that they're jet sources. They're not necessarily... haven't been identified.
I know there's also a big controversy on, you know, the measurement of how you compute the angular momentums for black holes. So I'm just taking bits of information of thinking that, you know, extreme black holes could be found out there. And I'm not claiming I agree with all the data and all that, but yeah. So... So here, I want to also make a point about some symmetries in the universe, and I'm going to be more concrete now. So let me just make some statements and, you know, live with them. But so gathering the information that we have so far, energy extraction is possible only for rotating Kerr black holes. And the greater the rotation, the easier it seems, at least from the numerical models, to extract energy. Moreover, if the process that occurs near the black hole horizon is actually very insensitive to what happens asymptotically, so very far away from the black hole. So this process is a process that actually occurs very close to the event horizon of black holes. This suggests that a lot of the physics of this force-free electrodynamics can be actually captured by looking at what we call the near horizon region of the black hole analytically. And in particular for this maximally rotating extreme Kerr black holes. And maybe I'm not sure about this, but you say that Sinus X1 is not one of the cases, but...
Well, it's a stellar mass black hole. The next year of binary, it's not one of these quasars that you're highlighting.
Okay. That's it. So... Fortunately, the dynamics of that region can be found analytically, and it's known especially in, you know, kind of more stringy setup as the NEC region. So for NEC, we just call the near horizon extreme Kerr metric. And I will show you that it's just simply a limit of the Kerr metric and is governed by some enhancement of something that is actually a conformal symmetry of the metric, which does not extend to the full Kerr geometry. So what we will do is take advantage to, you know, try to describe these equations close to the horizon for these extremal Kerr black holes and try to see whether the symmetry arguments that these metrics show actually help us in solving analytically the equations and seeing whether we can find some physical relevant solutions. So the idea then is to get analytical solutions for this, for the extremal case. So what happens then to the magnetospheres for extreme black holes? Well, can we solve the force-free equations, which is a valid argument in this neck region, so near the horizon of the extremal Kerr black holes? And if we have a metric that shows this symmetry, is this symmetry actually realized in the universe? So do solutions, for example, of the force-free equations realize the symmetry enhancement of this metrics? So the idea basically is that if we find a way to solve this, we will have a better understanding maybe of the astrophysics and black hole magnetospheres and the process of energy extraction. So that's more or less some tools that we'll need. So the plan is, I went through a 15-minute introduction, a very long introduction, but let me just mention now what this neck geometry is. So I will show you what the limit is and the metric that we are going to use. And I will show you the technique that we employed to successfully solve the equations, which relies a lot on symmetry arguments, and show you the new solutions that we found to these equations. They can be split in several ways, but one way we found useful is to find some solutions in which F squared is not zero, and then some of other solutions which are called null that have F squared equals zero. And then we found actually that some linear superpositions of these solutions, in spite of the equations being very, very nonlinear, are actually solutions of the equations. So I'm going to present to you an infinite number of solutions of this force-free equations. So, okay, this is the surprising part. So what is the neck geometry? So we all know Kerr black holes metric. It's in Boyard-Lindquist, it's just that. We have A is the parameter of rotation, and then we have some functions that are defined there, and M, capital M, is the mass of the black hole. So this metric is supposed to be, you know, representing every black hole out there. So it seems like a reasonable statement to try to find things related to this metric. So we can find the event horizon, and we see that for the event horizon to be real number, we need a bound. So if we fix the mass, there should be a maximum value of the rotation. And this is what we call the extremal or extreme Kerr solution. So that solution, we just take that metric there and we set up A to be M directly, which sets, you know, J to be M squared. So that's the extreme Kerr solution that we want. It is a smooth metric. It's a valid limit of the Kerr solution. And, you know, that's basically, we still have horizons. And it's basically a simple equation, a simple metric. So now how do we get to the Kerr black hole? Very Canadian. So we are interested in a region very near the horizon. So the way to do that is to just write some rescaling of the coordinates here and set then a limit of this lambda equals to zero. The first time this limit was performed was by Gary Horowitz and one of the collaborators back in the 90s. And so this metric would... that's right. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry about that. And this limit gives you that that neck geometry that we are interested in. So this metric is very simple, actually. It's this here. It's written here in Poincaré coordinates. And so we actually observe that there are some functions that we have to define, which are just theta dependent. Here and here, this lambda and gamma here, and those are the ranges of the coordinates. And so the event horizon now for the extremal neck geometry is at r equals 0. And now the metric, because we did a limit, is actually not longer asymptotically flat as Kerr black holes was, but it's something else, okay? So it's like being in the throat of the black hole. So a crucial feature, and this is the relevant part, and I'm going to play a lot with the symmetry group here on the right-hand side. A crucial feature is that the Kerr isometry group is U1 times U1. And when you take the limit of being extremal and close to the horizon, it actually is enhanced. So there's a special symmetry of the metric, which is this SL2R times U1 enhancement. So this enhancement symmetry governs, and we think, the dynamics of the near horizon region of the near extremal black holes. That's one argument. The U1 symmetry is generated by a Killing vector field that I will call W0. And the time translation symmetry becomes part now of the other bit, the SL2R isometry group here, and is generated by H0, H+, and H-. So I'm not sure how much is everyone familiar with isometries or that, but basically you see the symmetry of a metric by looking at the lead derivative with respect to the scaling vectors of G mu nu for the neck geometry, and you see that those are zero. So basically that's what you have to check, and this is what you can see for neck. So this satisfies the SL2R times U1 commutation. So once we define this Killing vector fields here, we see that they satisfy these relations. And you see here you have that the U1 commutes with the SL2R, which are these two equations here, and the two on the top are actually the SL2R representation. So these statements were done for what we call the Poincaré metrics, but we could, and we find it very useful, to work in global coordinates. So it's just basically a change of coordinates that is this here. So you see that now I'm going to describe my neck geometry by tau, psi, And then the same things as phi and theta. So I go to the global patch and write the same metric, the neck metric, in this way, which will be better for the way we finally solve the equations. If we do that, then we can also rewrite the Killing vector fields, the Killing vectors for the SL2R times U1 in this basis. So instead of the H basis, if you want, we are going to use the L basis. That's the language of, so it's basically when I say one base or the other, it's just Poincaré coordinates or global coordinates, basically. So these relations are obeyed, and of course, because they are just a coordinate transformation, the Killing vectors can be related in this way, right? So we have, this was the basis, H plus, H minus, H zero was the basis and the Poincaré patch, and these are the L's are in this global coordinate business. Okay? So the idea now gets more technical and mathy, and the idea is to exploit these symmetries. By that, we will take the force free equations, which are very nonlinear, and try to use the symmetries really to solve them. And so, to do that, what we will do is, let me just get there. So we will actually take a field strength and by ansatz, just not just solve the force-free equations, but we are going to enforce these equations here. In that way, if really the dynamics of the near extremal the near horizon of extremal care black holes is really, you know, the dynamic is described by the symmetry, then the fields, the field strength should also realize that symmetry. So the way to do that is you act with the lead derivative of your group, basically L plus, L zero, and Q zero is not the SL2R, one is the U1, and so you act with them, and you impose these conditions over here. So curly L is just the lead derivative with respect to the vector Killing fields that we were talking about before. So the last condition is the U1 invariant, and well, the first two conditions actually are what we call the highest weight representation of the SL2R with weight H. This is very, very technical. And for those that are not very interested in the math term, it's just a property that realizes that the F actually has those symmetries. So that has this SL2R times U1 symmetries. H is just a constant parameter. So if I act with a lead derivative on F, I get a constant and back F. That's basically the idea. So the L plus is, so the L basis is a complex basis. And so all the solutions that I will show you are actually complex. However, and you know, I would not be talking here if we found solutions that are complex. Those are not interesting. So what we did is we took the real and imaginary parts of these solutions, and in spite of what we thought that we would not find solutions, they were actually solutions of the force-free equations. So that was very, very surprising to us. So if you take the real or imaginary part, as I will show you, of these field strengths, and you plug them into the force-free equation, you find that those are actually solutions of your system and would describe, of course, real or more realistic physics. So so we will find solutions to the force-free conditions and on top of that, force-free equations, and on top of that, we are going to restrain our solution set to solutions that fulfilled those equations over there. So maybe we were asking for too much. You know, at the beginning when, you know, we started talking about this, there was the possibility that if you try so much to realize the symmetry to, you know, it didn't really have to be there. So we could have ended up with no solutions. But instead of that, we found too many solutions for my taste. So One thing that we are going to see later on for, and it's just a definition, is the energy flux. And so these definitions, we will check that how to describe energy and angular momentum flux from this neck geometry. So what we will do is take the U1 symmetry that is generated by W0 and then time translations. This is in Poincaré coordinates. Time translation symmetry and take the H plus Keeling vector and then define the stress tensor. And with that, we can actually contract with these vectors here and define what we call the energy current for these solutions. So what we will see is that these energy currents are conserved. And therefore, if we make an integral over all the region in the bulk, actually, the energy has to be conserved. So that will imply that if we take, you know, the total energy flux through the past and future event horizons, which are basically these two bits here, and we add the energy at the boundary, then it should be conserved and be zero. So this is what we'd say here. So the total energy crossing into the future horizon in global coordinates is in this surface, and this one is minus the energy coming out from the past horizon, and here delta EB is the boundary of the throat, which is at psi equals pi in this global coordinates. So these quantities are smooth across the horizon and are almost conveniently computed in global coordinates. So what we will do, and I will show you some videos of what these are, is actually, you know, the integrals in global space time coordinates for the neck geometry of these energy fluxes through the different horizons and the boundary. So, okay, so the energy flux density per solid angle of the horizon and the boundary of the throat can be defined in this way. And so I take the energy currents and perform these contractions and define some induced three metrics on the boundary, and gamma denotes the two metric on the event horizon to find and define the different energy fluxes or the density of the energy. So a completely analogous story holds for the angular momentum. So we can do the same thing and now take the angular momentum. So instead of taking the energy, the time vector, we will take the phi direction. So in what follows, I will evaluate the energy and angular momentum densities at the horizon and the boundary of the neck region to show that the force-free equations or solutions that I find, or we find, do actually produce some non-trivial fluxes. So I will now talk on the results that we found. So let me be more precise in how to classify these solutions. So we have some solutions that I will show you in more detail, which we will label with this subindex H and K. I will be more precise of what they are, but they're pretty simple. So basically, if you you will see that if you take these Keeling vectors here and you explicitly write them down and you can act n times with the Lie derivative, this gauge field will be actually a solution of the force-free equations. And so there's something, if you take h equals 0 and k equals 0, we will label them as being the maximal symmetric solutions. And for a reason I will describe to you. And the highest weight solutions from which we generalize the first solutions that we found are the ones with h non-zero and k equals 0. And on top of that, we have something called the descendants, which is something that has to do with the fact that because we are using some symmetric arguments, in the same way as you act with operators in quantum mechanics to annihilate or to lower one of the states, In the same way here, we can act with L minus and find the descendants of the solutions. And in that way, the descendants will, with those with the K, so if we act with, you know, this operator L minus, we get also solutions which have now a dependence on this K value that are also solutions of the force free equations. So basically, that's what we'll do. There's a completely separate set of solutions, which are these null solutions that have a very simple expression, and we can also generalize as being, you know, highest weight, and also the descendants of them can be found by acting with the elements of the group. And the linear superposition of solutions would look something like that. But so here, let me stress that we take the real or imaginary parts of this, and we are linearly combining them. So there is an infinite number of solutions that you can add, actually, and this gauge field will satisfy your force-free equations. Interestingly enough, the energies on angular momentum currents will have non-trivial currents, but the total flux will be zero. And basically, that would be because the solutions that we found in these categories do have field lines that do not reach the boundary, and therefore they will stay within you know, the region of the neck geometry. So let me just mention two things. So recently, Luis and I think Juan, I don't know one of the other collaborators. Okay. So those solutions are not within any of this set of solutions. And basically, there is a generalization that one can make in which the solutions that you found can be put in, but they will not appear here in this cases. They will be related to some solutions that Tate Jacobson found, but not yours. So let me talk about the maximal symmetric one. So the solution looks very, very simple. It's just this solution over here, which looks complex. But as I said, you take the real or imaginary part of that solution, and you find a real solution of the force-free equations. So for the maximally symmetric case, we could actually eliminate this term here, which is just, you know, this is the gauge. So this is just a gauge transformation. But it will be good to have that for a generalization for the next section. So we have two functions that have to be defined. We have P0, which is a function of theta that we have to find, and this phi here, which is a tau and psi dependent function, has this property here. So these are the solutions, and we say that this solution over here is SL2R times E1 invariant, because when we act with the scaling vectors on it, there's always zero. So that is what the maximal symmetric means. So just for the sake of, you know, knowing what we are generating, you can see that, you know, you can write this, the field strength, and see that there are electric and magnetic components of the field that you're generating. And okay, this is just a definition of that part there. And so how can we prove in two lines that actually the solutions that we are proposing are actually solutions of the force-free equations? Well, a way to do that is to write what the current is as D dagger F, and write the star of F, which is basically this here, and check that we need an extra equation. So we haven't, we didn't define what P0 was, but to get this, the force-free equation to hold when we plug this into the equation here, we need to solve this differential equation. It is a very simple equation, and we can integrate it, and we see that to have a smooth non-singular solution in the region that we want, we have to set d0 to be 0 and z0 to be a real function. So the current and the field strength are actually this here. So there is a solution to 6 that is 0, and 6, let me just tell you, which were these symmetry equations. So what we have is a solution that if we act with L plus L0 and Q0 with a lead derivative on this field, we get 0, 0, and 0. Okay? So now I will show you the generalization to this with H non-zero. And those are what we call the highest weight solutions. So we construct a large family that are axisymmetric to the force free equations by representing them as this. So we came up with an ansatz once we found that to see whether we could actually change the value of h. There will be an issue with h equals 1, and I will show you what that is. But basically, for all other values of h, we can find this solution. And so if you take this solution now and plug it into the force-free equations, you will see that they are solved. So the function here, phi of h, is basically a highest weight scalar of this group. And so we can fix what the function is. For h equals 0, we go back to the solution that we have previously found. And for h equals 1, I will separate them because the solution will become here very special and they will become a null solution. So the h equals 1 doesn't work, but all the other values do. So the field strength in this case where we are taking the highest weight solution looks like this. It looks very complicated, but because we were, you know, working with an ansatz for the gauge field, it wasn't really that hard to find. So if we take the Hodge of the field strength there, you get this equation here, and you can find the current. So you can see, and this is why H equals 1 is trivial, in the sense that if we take H equals 1, you get J equals 0, which is a solution to the homogeneous Maxwell's equations. So it doesn't make really sense because the force-free equations will trivially hold. And so the case H equals 1 doesn't really, you know, give you anything new. And you can see that you can wedge the current with the star F and get 0. Basically, one has to look at these equations, and why we are using forms is because it's, to the eye, very simple to check this equation. So J, the current, is proportional to this Killing vector Q0, and star of F, of our field strength over there, is also proportional. In each term, we have a Q0. So when we wedge something proportional to Q0 with something proportional to Q0, every term cancels and we get the zero on the right-hand side, and we solve the force-free equations. That's why we found it more a simpler representation for used forms. But in this case, the equation that before for h equals 1, this term wasn't there, becomes more complicated. And we have to still solve for what pH of theta is in that solution. So the way we proceed is to look hard at the differential equation, which is or falls into a category of what we call the generalized Hund functions. And this is a huge, you know, field of study in math. So the way to solve this, in particular, we have two singular points in this equation. We can actually solve it by Frobenius method, which is just taking an expansion of the solution and plugging it in. And then we have some definitions for the coefficients in the expansion that we can write in closed form. So what we see is that for the pH of theta, we can actually solve in the domain of interest between 0 and pi and get some you know, smooth solutions. You can't see them here, but there are some other plots over here for the different ages. But what is important here that you see is that So if you have your black hole, it has to have some symmetry respect to pi over 2, where your plane, the pi over 2 equals theta is the plane and the equator, and the pole is at theta equals 0. So that's very important. And so we see that these solutions are actually show this symmetry respect to the equatorial plane. So, okay, we were lucky. And then we can find what F square is. And this has a story in astrophysics of why we look at that. And it's not zero, but complex for the complex solutions. When we take the real or imaginary parts, this will become also either real or imaginary. Purely complex. So the SL2R invariance of NEC guarantees that the SL2 transformations of the above highest weight solutions are solutions. But that's only guaranteed if you take linear equations. So if we don't have linear equations, why would the descendants be also solutions of the original one? It turns out that despite that nonlinearity, we can find that the descendants are also solutions of the force-free equations. And for these reasons, we can just simply see it by taking a closer look at what the gauge field is. And so if we act... What we do to generalize the solutions that I show you in the last transparency is just act with the lead derivative on these vectors here, this combination, we will have the same theta function for all the descendants and see that we get an infinite tower of new solutions for the gauge field. The dual field strength and current are of these forms. And what happens is that since both the highest weight dual field strength and the current, so star F and J, are proportional to Q0, as you see here, and believe me that star F is actually proportional to Q0, then when we act with L minus 2 towards Q0, that's 0. And therefore, all the descendants that will have these terms here for J and D star F, will be 0 and will be solutions of the force-free equations over here. So that's kind of a technical way of realizing why this works. So the reality condition can be actually, thought to be, very surprising. At least it was very surprising for us. So if you take the real part or imaginary part of a nonlinear, of a solution for a nonlinear equation, why would that solve your equations? So, but we observe that actually that's the case. And basically, it's related to the fact that the solutions that we found for, the currents and the star F are proportional to Q0. And so what happens is that when we take the real or imaginary parts of those, the real and imaginary parts are also proportional to Q0, and therefore themselves are also solutions, although they will not be anymore, satisfying the symmetry conditions or the highest weight equations. So it is important to note that the physical solutions then no longer have a complex F squared. Rather, we find F squared that can be positive or negative at different points in space-time. And we can take linear superpositions of the solutions. We check that. And you can find, as many solutions as you want, a superposition of this. And the force-free equations are satisfied. The way we understood it finally is that in some sense, when we impose the symmetry arguments, what we are doing hiddenly in some way that we could not prove it is actually linearizing in some sense the equations. And there's the hidden way in which this is happening for the ansatz that we have, but this is effectively what we think we did. So one can go on and take, for example, let me just show you if you take the real parts of one of this field strength FH0, you get this energy fluxes at the horizons. The angular momentum fluxes are zero. And at infinity, at the boundary, we see that the fluxes are zero. And so what we see is that the total energy flux then stays within the throat. So the delta EB, which is the boundary of this neck region, is still zero. So some words on this other result in which F squared is null. I would take a moment to do that because this, we think, are related to Ted Jacobson's solutions that they found for full care. And we think that if you take those solutions and take the extremal limit, you can actually find that they are, we didn't check that, but they fall into this category because Ted's solutions actually were null. They were F squared equals zero. So therefore, they cannot fit in the other model that I just showed you. So if you consider this gauge field, it also will have an associated field strength. But now the function of theta here, p tilde, can be any arbitrary regular function. And what we see is that for our ansatz, this eigenfunction psi is actually a U1 eigenfunction, because if I act with L plus on psi, it's not longer zero, but it's some number. So to show that it actually solves, now the J current and star F are not longer proportional to Q0, but this combination of the Killing fields. And because the current is proportional to the same same combination of vectors, and the star F2, then if we just wedge them, we will solve the force-free equations. So that's the rule of the thumb. If you want to solve by, you know, looking at the symmetries, what you need to find is some ansatz for the current and the star F in order to wedge them and get to zero. The same here, story applies here. So you can act now when you have these null solutions with L minus and get a lot of other solutions. Again, the J and the star F are proportional to these combinations here, and therefore all the descendants will also solve the force-free equations. These solutions do have also show some flux at the boundary and asymptotically, but again, and we checked that the total energy is actually conserved in these cases. So one can similarly do that for the imaginary parts and get non-trivial fluxes. So let me show you something we worked on to kind of try to show a little bit more about the physics. So we did many videos, but this is one. So here you see, is this running? Yeah. So on the left-hand side, you see the the electric field strength here. And you see this is, we have non-stationary solutions. So this is a time evolution of what the electric field is doing. So we see this log, the black hole is sitting in the center, and therefore the field lines never leave that region. And you can also watch the same or a similar thing happening for the magnetic field, actually. And so you can, so it's kind of kicks off very slowly. So this is what the field lines look for the magnetic part. So we have these lobs of, you know, magnetic fields that are in time growing and shrinking, and the black hole is in the center. It depends. They will have a different. If you take just one of the solutions without the superposition or whatever, usually they will be magnetically dominated. But because you can actually add them up and whatever, you can generate whatever you want.
So just,
almost.
So
may be spread in your paper, because I thought this was you guys were obtaining path regions for electrically dominated.
Yes, there. So that's so it depends what kind of solutions you use. You can see how they are dominated by just squaring F and getting whether it's positive or negative. So most of the solutions are negatively dominated, but it will depend on, you know, the space time. So we'll flip from positive to negative, depending whether, you know, for some values of your T, theta, the
right,
point.
Yeah. Or the equations to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be money dominated.
Everywhere. Yes. Yeah.
So you have solutions where they're money dominated everywhere, at every single point of your
network. We haven't checked that.
Okay.
I'm not sure how to. Okay, you can do that, but we found too many solutions. So I'm not sure if you add them up, and you know, maybe there's a way to kill the electric part all the time by, you know, some combination. But I'm not sure if you can do that. So my bet is that probably this all this set of solutions, they're smooth, they're valid solutions of the force-free equation, but it could be that they're electrically dominated. But it depends, and you know, I cannot put my hands on, you know, the whatever superposition of this. So finally, we also had some videos that you can, I will show you just one for the current. So we have non-trivial currents. This is the energy current density. And it has these surfaces that we also do not understand. We took these analytical solutions and just, you know, made these videos. So they look very curious. And, you know, we haven't thought about the physics or how relevant they could be for the astro observations, but they are there. So, okay, this is basically what I wanted to say, and thank you for listening. Thanks.
So in your search, do you have any, is there anything that you think would prevent you from finding solutions that would have net flux through the horizon?
No, it's just coming up with a good answer, I guess.
And is the answer also tied to the particular representation you're choosing, or?
So we have generalized this. So one question we had, some other general solutions that we are, you know, in the process of publishing or writing up, and they will include some of the solutions that you find. The ones that you have do have some flux, right? And so what we find is actually some more symmetric solutions that do show this energy flux at the boundary. But how to distinguish...
So did you have to change your representation to find that?
No.
Okay. So
no.
The same,
yeah. So what is very puzzling is if we have these equations now and we can solve them, how do we tell the astrophysicist which ones will, you know, be the ones that actually suit the whatever findings they see? And it seems that these equations do show, you know, infinite number of solutions and blah, blah, blah. Of course, the electrically dominated ones would not represent the astrophysics, you know, models. But if you find a tower of solutions, which is the relevant solution to these equations that actually fits the observations. So, yeah.
So
yes?
Along those lines, historically, the problem wasn't finding solutions. It was finding the solution that mattered. And that was dictated usually by the boundary conditions you're going to apply at large distances. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's no accident that if you go read the Blanche and Nyack paper, they're busy drawing current diagrams. I mean, this GS project that explained this to you, first thing he'll draw is a circuit with resistors. Okay? And then, because he's trying to work out the current balance, that's going to determine what the final quasi stationary state has to look like after all of the dynamics that's going to go on are taken care of. Right? I mean, we know multiple families of waves. Free. There's all kinds of freedom to do things, but it settles down based upon these global boundaries. And so I wanted to ask, when you restrict yourself to looking at How would you, even in principle, begin to incorporate the global boundary condition information that seems to have been so important historically?
So, two comments. On one hand, it's true that boundary conditions do are a very important part of the problem. But I'm not sure there are too many solutions that we know of the force-free equations, not even, you know, close to being smooth or, you know, whatever. So I think there's a problem of how you solve those equations. And it's a coupled system. Even if you restrict to stationary and axisymmetric solutions, you get, you know, a highly non-trivial differential equation, which cannot be solved for Kerr's fully. So it's actually finding a solution to that equation will probably be a problem.
But I can take like Gretsch Efron equation. I can write it down. I can pause it on a flux function. I can numerically solve. I mean, getting an analytical solution is nice and pretty, but I
it will. The character of the solution will break for extremal care if you want. And also, let me tell you about something about numerics. It's true that you can run your code, but if you have to pay $1 million every time I want to shift the value of the parameter, isn't it better maybe if you can just analytically solve the equation or find a way to see whether if it's extremal, you would get some solution? So imagine this. If I tell you that all the solutions to these equations for the extremal black hole will have zero flux, then what's the purpose of trying to fit a model or even think of numerically solving that to try to see whether you get flux when you're going to pay $1 million and then get zero flux? So I agree that maybe this sounds very, you know, mathy or whatever, but there's a structure here. And regarding, you know, the issue about the boundary conditions and things like that, I agree this is a very fundamental thing. And so now how to get information from this neck geometry when you're very close to the horizon and fit it to what happens asymptotically, this is a second order problem of how you get the energy once it reached the boundary and get it out there. But so far, the solutions that we show here are not even, you know, going to the boundary. So we don't have energy. We see some energy, whatever, density inside this region. So there, you can generate these field lines and get solutions, but they're not, there's not energy that is reaching the boundary. So the way and the answer to your question is that if you have this metric and you get non-zero trivial flux for the boundary of neck, now you have to glue it to some other space that is asymptotically flat. And so that's it. And that's a, you know, you can continue the problem and do that analytically. And, you know, if we had done that, we could, you know, make some prediction. But that, you know, is a second order problem. First, we need at least some solutions to play with. Yeah,
so,
I agree. Yeah, but so let's start from where we have to start, which is trying to see if we can get some solutions close to the horizon, and then see if we can glue it to something else that we know. We can even do that numerically if you want, you know.
But that is the second question of, you know, once you get those solutions, how to do that. And we're, you know, on our way of trying to understand that. And for me, the magic is, wouldn't it be really cool to see that not black holes are just described by the Kerr metrics, but if we go close to them, they are actually these symmetries that tell us so much, you know. It's kind of, you know, mind-blowing from a mathy perspective that you have this model that could actually give you, you know, some magic of symmetry there. But yeah, so it's both valid.
Interesting questions, but yeah, so.
Yes, that's
the
same question. Could be. You're finding it by guidance with respect to the symmetry of the set.
Oh, yeah, it could definitely be.
But if we knew analytically a solution with the proper boundary conditions to full care, and I take that solution, which is smooth, make the
extremal limit and make it near extremal, then that should give one solution. It might not be the ones that we have here with the symmetries, but there will be a limit of the full care solution analytically that will have a limit to this neck limit.
Any other questions? Good job, Maria is visiting you tomorrow afternoon. I'm chasing room 373.
Great, thank you.